that monstrous universal sense of having no place wherein we fit. How powerful is such a place in your lives and in this world? How powerful is the yearning for people and places that offer us acceptance and attention and affirmation and affection? How powerful is that craving for love? It was powerful enough to convince Matthew Shepard to take the risks he took when he went with the men who killed him that night. It's powerful because the alternative to remaining to that choice is to remain living in uncertainty, living in fear and isolation, to live with the daily grind of ignoring our need for acceptance and affection. The alternative is to look for places where we can hide or where we can build what I call prophylactic lives, where protecting ourselves means establishing an impenetrable barrier between us and pain that nothing can cross, not even any of our other feelings. And so we adopt norms and we remain aloof and we never stick our neck out or make ourselves vulnerable. And the reward, if we become really good at that over years of time, is not only safety, but honor. Our culture really honors that kind of behavior, and we give it the badge, the coveted badge, of rugged individualism. I began earning my badge very early in life. I grew up in an ethnically diverse neighborhood in East Los Angeles, where no one had to point out the hesitation or the tension or the disease that was felt in the neighborhood. You just had to observe the look in people's eyes when they saw one another. To get away, my family and I went to a place called DeBenneville Pines, which is a Unitarian Universalist conference center in the Southern California mountains. And we started going there a couple years after the original lodge had burned down, the place where the community gathered. And in the place that remained, in the field there, we ate and sang and did programs. And one day when I was six, as part of a worship service, the minister rang a bell and asked the question of what it would take to build, as Dr. King had been referring to up until that time, what it would take to build the beloved community. And we were asked to go out and collect stones, the biggest that we could find, and think about how we might be able to use those stones and what we would build. So, let me give you a tip. If you want to make a worship service very exciting for a six-year-old boy, ask him to go out and collect stones. The bigger, the better. Because I ran from that circle. Before anyone could even stand up, I was already collecting an entire pile of stones. And I formed my pile of stones away from the rest of the group, wanting to distinguish myself. My unconscious instincts for self-preservation revealed themselves as I began piling up my stones into a small fort. But since my instincts for protection were more developed than my instincts for structural design, it was not a very good fort. And that must have been very clear to almost everybody else except for me, that my fort was more likely to fall in and crush me than to protect me. That notion first began to dawn on me when I looked over the rim of my tiny fort and I saw that everyone else had taken their stones and spread them out in a big clearing next to one another. Well, that's a pretty stupid looking fort, I thought to myself. But that's when the bells started to go off in my head that maybe building a fort wasn't really what we had in mind. Going the hard way alone, struggling to protect ourselves, defiantly establishing outposts with our lives. Our culture has rewarded this image with a sense of valor and heroism. Look at how we have idolized people like Clint Eastwood and Jack Kerouac and James Dean. But as psychiatrist and author M. Scott Peck points out, there is also a danger with this. He writes, I quote, "It is impossible to be totally adequate, self-sufficient, independent beings. Yet the ideal of individual, rugged individualism encourages us to fake it. It encourages us to hide our weaknesses and our failures. It teaches us to be utterly ashamed of our limitations. It drives us to attempt to be superwomen and supermen, not only in the eyes of others, but in our own eyes as well. It pushes us day in and day out to look as if we had it all together, as if we were without needs and in total control of our circumstances, which we know is impossible. It also isolates us from one another, even in our moments of greatest need. And it makes genuine community impossible." End quote. Going it alone carries a price. It means never having the chance to share what we know to be the truest parts of ourselves, the tender parts, the parts that we push down, our fears, our dreams, and we push them so deep down that we stop paying attention to them, stop feeling anything at all. And it's at this point that real relationship becomes impossible. For love is always based on mutuality, on give and take. Rugged individualists know very little about this. They make for poor partners. They build poor community. And if we are fortunate in life, we will have some of those people in our lives who care enough about us to keep us from going that route. I wasn't the only one to notice that my rugged individualism, like my fort, was threatening to collapse in upon me. My mother noticed it as well, and she walked across the clearing to where I had piled my stones up, and she took my hand and told me that it was time to go join the others. How humiliating, I thought to myself. A rugged individualist would never be caught dead holding hands with his mother. But when we got to where she was leading us, I could see what she had come to get me for. There, coming up the road by the clearing, were big trucks and cement mixers. Suddenly, I noticed work crews and scaffolding. There was framing and pouring of concrete. We weren't building a fort. We were building a home. It was turning out to be that place of the central lodge that would stand on that property for the next 40 years. A place that in my teenage years I would run away to and call home. It was a place that I am quite certain saved my life. The stones that were gathered were for building the hearth around the fireplace, that place where people would gather and sit and tell stories. Every stone was to be included. And so, as this was explained, instinctively I ran back to my fort to get the biggest stone that I could carry across because I wanted to make sure that it was included. But what I really wanted was to know that I was included. What I really wanted to know that I was part of that community, a place that would know me and care for me and stand up for me, a place wherein I fit. There is a need for such places in the world. In the words of theologian Carter Hayward, she writes, "Love is not mushy. It is concrete. Love is active, a matter of making reciprocal and mutually beneficial relations with one's friends and enemies. Love is hard. Righteousness and justice are built from it. As advocates for justice know, loving involves heavy lifting, resistance, risk. Making justice is not a warm, fuzzy experience because loving involves commitment. Love is not a choice. It is a willingness to be present with others without pretense or guile. Love is a conversion to humanity, a willingness to participate with others in the rebuilding of a broken world and the restoration of broken lives. End quote. That describes what I believe we are called to do when we hear bells, when we notice that things around us are not right. It's time to reach out, to take hands that are palsied by fear, establishing strength by realizing that it doesn't mean establishing protection. It's about establishing company. There's a story by writer Anne Lamott about her older brother who at the age of 10 was trying to get a report written on birds that he'd had 3 months to write. It was due the next day. They were out at their family cabin in Bolinas, California, and he was at the kitchen table, close to tears, surrounded by paper and binders and unopened books on birds, immobilized by the hugeness of the task before him. And sensing the boy's despair, his father sat down beside him and pulled his son into his lap, and he told him, "Bird by bird, kid, just take it bird by bird." Here in Prince William County, in our pledge to be a safe community to seek and serve, we live amidst this kind of hardship and overwhelm. We live in an area where many people every night go to bed hungry. Amidst our affluence, they go to bed hungry. We live in an area where tens of thousands of people, just like Mary Petrakis described earlier, lost their homes, where thousands more low-income, elderly, and disabled are forced to move from their homes because they can't afford or they're not able to fix them. Building a beloved community with these people can be an overwhelming task unless you know enough to take it bird by bird. By letting down our emotional walls and opening up our hearts, we welcome some of the stray flyers who have had to fly the coop and need a new place to nest. Rugged individualists will warn you about what happens when you try to do such things. People will swarm here. You will be overwhelmed, they say. And if we keep opening our doors, they're right. Through these doors will come some pretty odd birds, some lovebirds, some goonie birds, some doves of peace, some wild birds, some tame ones, some preening peacocks, some tough old hens, some soaring eagles, some chickens, some wise old owls, some spry sparrows, and yes, even some turkeys. But every one of them, like every one of you, will have come here looking for a place in the flock where they think of themselves as birds of a feather, where no one rules the roost, but everyone is willing to feather the nest, where there is room for one more bird on the branch, one more stone in the hearth, one more hand that is reaching out, and one more reminder that somewhere in this world there is that place wherein we fit. 14 years ago, the UU Fellowship of Laramie found themselves overwhelmed and being that place for many people. Deeply involved in Wyoming's attempt to come to grips with Matthew Shepard's death, the congregation marched in the university's homecoming parade, where a contingent of 30 members swelled to nearly 500 as bystanders joined together in solidarity. A letter from the congregation appeared in the Laramie Daily Boomerang, expressing sympathy for friends and family and letting gays and lesbians know that the fellowship was and always would be an open and caring sanctuary. While Matthew Shepherd lay in a coma, 150 people attended a vigil at the fellowship held at the request of Matthew Shepherd's friends. The next morning, Shepherd died. My UU youth advisor, Rob Eller Isaacs, now the minister of Unity Temple in Minneapolis, Minnesota, tells a similar story about how he faced the need for community after hearing the shooting death of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He was 15 and living in Chicago when the news came over the radio, and Robbie had always been moved by the message of Dr. King, believing that together people could overcome their differences which divided them and cultivate a love which united them. News of Dr. King's death was shattering and the need to hide was overwhelming, but Rob moved in a different direction. Together with a friend, they ran down the streets of Chicago, feeling that there was only one place that they could turn with a grief this powerful. So they pushed through the big, heavy wooden doors of the Unitarian Church, ran through the empty sanctuary, up a small flight of stairs to the bottom of the bell tower. And there, a rope hung down. And reacting on instinct, Rob grabbed the rope and began to pull. Now, there are two ways that you can ring a bell. The first way is that when that rope hangs down, you can pull and let go. And that makes a sound that is called pealing the bells. It's kind of a happy sound, a Sunday morning sound. But there is another way. You can grab onto the rope and pull down and hang on to it with all your might, which forces the bell to ring only once. That is usually known as a community signal of distress. It is what's called tolling the bells. In order to toll the bell, you have to pull the rope down and hold on to it with all your might to keep it from peeling. And that's what they did. For 10 minutes, they took turns tolling the bell. When one was tired, the other took over until they were both exhausted, resisting the weight of the bell. And then they sat there in their grief and their silence. Rob said that he didn't know why he ran to the church, just that it was the only place big enough and safe enough that he could trust with his pain. He didn't know why he chose to ring the bell, just that it was the only way that he could scream loud enough at a sometimes senseless and frightening world. To me, having community means having somewhere to turn when the brokenness of the world and the brokenness within me are so visible that we cannot hide or deny either one. It means knowing that there are relationships that are possible even when my own greatest wounds are revealed, and knowing those around me won't lash out or turn away. It means knowing that when my reserves are low, someone will make that journey in the dark of the night to replenish my soul, and it means knowing that I would do the same thing for them. After 15 minutes of sitting in the bell tower, the two boys got up, not knowing where to go next or what to do now or how to face the unthinkable. They walked down the steps leading back into the sanctuary, and there they saw with their eyes what their minds could not believe. A room filled with people. Not a few people looking sheepish or confused, but a room full from end to end. People in grief, people in need, people standing hand in hand. People who heard the same news, who felt the same way, who recognized the same bell and knew the only place they could turn was the same place, a place where they could bring their own brokenness to stand amidst the brokenness around them. Some were members, others just knew that it was a place they could go, a place they could be safe, a place wherein they fit. And it is here that my temple shall be built, for this is a holy place. This is a place where God is made known. This is a place where human beings discover each other in love. What would it look like if we built such a place here? Let us use our imagination following the words of Marilyn Sewell, former minister of the Portland Church. It will be a place of quiet and rest. It will be a place of learning and celebration. It will be a place where our stories can be told without fear. It will be a place where the wealthy and the needy, the gay and the straight, the black and the white, the Christian and the Jew and the humanist sit side by side and learn how much we all have in common and how much we need each other. We will not talk much of individual salvation, of lives being saved, for that kind of talk will be a luxury when lives are lost every day. Our hands will extend out well beyond ourselves, and it is there in that reaching out that we will find that place wherein we fit. For that is what you find in community, and this is community. Forever. Amen.